Thank you very much. I have to say that I'm going to depart and speak on a slightly different perspective than perhaps what we've heard so far today. It is true that in 30 years of doing science diplomacy, I don't believe I ever had the opportunity in a presentation to say that I'm going to talk about fun and science in the same sentence. But essentially, this presentation will be more oriented toward fun and how science that is fun and learning of science that is fun is also a mechanism of building bridges of cooperation and of understanding. Let me just begin by stating the obvious, which is that the spirit of inquiry, the curiosity that we all know operates at some level in across the entire human species. So what's unique about society today in so many ways is that today the public more than ever before has views. Whether those views might be determined or viewed as scientific is perhaps open to question. Are these views fact-based? Are they derived through some objective process of understanding? Again, open to debate. But it is clear that what we need more than anything else right now is a common recognition of the value of science, of a rational sense of the expectations of science, and still a sense of aspiration regarding where science might be able to take us. And the premise that I would like to present to you today is that perhaps to get to that point, we need to come together around new forms of science learning. We need to break free from some of the traditional means by which we go about science learning. And as part of that process, we need to actually engage the science community in venues and in ways other than the traditional research engagement that most of us as researchers have been familiar with. We need to bring them out of the research community into the public in ways that will help better public understanding and better public engagement on these critical issues. And bear in mind that I will end on fun in the entire presentation. Let me begin here by, see if I've got this right. There are a few obvious statistics that surveys continually bring out over and over again. The first of which is that for the most serious and long-term issues that are facing the public today, there is a common understanding that these are issues that revolve around science. We've heard this over and over again in certain perspectives. These few slides that I'll show here go to a more personal level, though. How do you as an individual, how does the public as individuals see that science in their daily lives? And the topics that you see here are topics that you might expect to be priorities for the public in these areas. It's also true that overwhelmingly, the public says that scientific innovation improves their standard of living, not just their survival, but the quality of their lives. And that the majority of the population say that scientific research today affects that quality in ways that it has never in the past. Now, when we talk about that quality, where is science research taking us? This is an interesting slide for me. Clearly, healthcare, one would imagine, would be at the top of that list. It's the personal sense of where science plays out in human life. I found it interesting that in these surveys, and these surveys date back only a matter of the past few years, energy, for example, was not viewed as a priority in daily life. Now, is that a question of education? Is it a question of understanding? Is it a question of senses of urgency around science? But the fact is that while the public may not understand a global sense of a science concern, they certainly understand science in their personal lives, which is the reason why you see issues like healthcare and communications at the top of these lists. Moreover, a majority of the population feel that public policies should be influenced more by scientific evidence than by personal belief. Now, that isn't to say that we aren't seeing expressions of personal belief in most of the decisions that are made by policymakers, and that we don't understand that science operates within context, shall we say. But generally speaking, the public understands the objective value of scientific evidence as part of the policy process. So one of the things that we are learning, and these next few slides obviously draw from American examples, but Americans consistently endorse the past achievements and the future promise of science and technology. At the same time, while they are expressing consistently high levels of interest in science and technology, Americans, by and large, are not able to give correct answers to questions about basic facts concerning science. And perhaps more importantly, and part that I think concerns me a bit more, is that they don't really have a general sense of the process of scientific inquiry, the scientific method, if we will. And by the way, these are not uniquely American statistics in this regard. These are trends that we are seeing in countries around the world. So what we can derive from this is that a scientifically and technologically literate citizenry is going to require a lifelong STEM learning process, science, technology, engineering, and math learning. And we also recognize that a strong technical workforce means that we need to get our students and we need to get our public engaged and interested in science early in life. There's a very interesting study done out of the OECD, which I think we are still beginning to analyze, which essentially shows that there is a shift in our understanding of science from a measurement done by test scores versus a measurement done by science curiosity. And what we are finding is that many countries that rank the highest in terms of science test scores do not necessarily rank as high when it comes to science curiosity and interest in science. In many cases, they rank lower, considerably lower, with regard to science interest and science curiosity. To explain the pattern to date, a lot of that emphasis is on the school culture itself, the area of formal education and the role that it plays in driving science interest. There are two other studies that I have found very interesting, and they lead very much to the work that we do in my association. And that is that it has been shown that eighth grade students who indicated an interest in science were three times more likely to pursue a college degree in sciences than those who ultimately scored high in standardized tests at the end of their high school experience. And by the way, I did an abbreviated version of this statistic. What I found even more compelling is that they are more than three times likely to engage in physical sciences. They're about twice as likely to engage in life sciences. But the drive toward physical sciences is markedly higher when the interest starts before eighth grade. A similar study in a review of a series of scientists demonstrated that overwhelmingly these scientists can point to times when their interest in science began for them. And for a large number of them, that is before or about the age 11 years. And for most of them, they have said that what drove that interest was what we would call an informal science experience, science outside of the classroom. So what we have come to realize is the time that we spend, all of us, in science and in math classes, in formal education in these areas, is less than 1% of our waking hours. And yet, adults realize and report that they use a full range of informal science education sources for their lifelong learning. There's an interesting aspect of this, which is that if you look at the statistics worldwide, and you see the trends for youth in their science understanding, up till about third grade, students around the world are in roughly the same level of science understanding. And then it drops off when they are in their teens. And this, of course, when we hear in America about the gaps and the concerns about science understanding, it starts being measured in about the teens. But when you get back to the adults, you find that those levels tend to equalize again. And what's driving that to a large extent is not what you learned in the classroom, but what you learned in life's experience and in the informal science environment. So we know that there is a level of knowledge, there's a level of understanding out there that comes from outside of the formal classroom. So we are now speaking about non-school learning environments, and I would argue that these environments are environments that generate interest, they're environments that generate engagement in science. They do build capacity, they certainly build confidence with regard to science, and they do impact academic performance, ultimately leading, where possible, to academic and career paths in the sciences. So there is a very interesting National Research Council study recently that talked about this role of non-school settings and comes to the conclusion that from the standpoint of policymakers, practitioners, and researchers alike, they need to realize the important role that out-of-school learning will play in better science understanding and science engagement. So where does this take us globally? Because the whole concept of our discussion is how we might be able to build bridges of understanding and engagement using these varied forms of science learning. I found it interesting that the UN Commission on Sustainable Development, through their Education Working Group, made a point of saying that environmental education and sustainability is a key element of the Rio process and is a key element of a better appreciation of sustainability in our lives. And they went on to say that where the majority of environmental education opportunities exist, where we will see an emphasis on sustainability is far and away more likely outside of the classroom, outside of the school environment. Similarly, the UN High-Level Panel on Global Sustainability in its meeting in September of 2010 made a special point of emphasizing the responsibility for guidance and leadership in the formal, the non-formal, and the informal learning environment. And they went on to say that education for sustainable development takes place in each of these venues, in formal, in non-formal, and in informal. And it is through the facilitation and support of these non-formal educators that they're able to bring together a variety of social contexts around an important global issue like sustainability. So let me just say a word or two about how this process actually works. So if you take, for example, a science center, a science museum, or a center of science learning anywhere in your community, more and more today, these science centers become an amalgam of the science represented in the community itself. They are collections of universities and corporations and think tanks and research laboratories, media organizations, more and more, schools. All of these environments together come together to provide a platform of science knowledge and science awareness for the community. What's interesting about these centers is that 90% of them are actually conducting classes, doing demonstrations, and utilizing the science community for better public understanding. Nearly 90% are doing school outreach programs. They are teaching the teachers. They are training the trainers in experiential learning in science. They're helping to develop curriculum and new materials. They're working with homeschoolers. They're working with seniors. And more they are engaging youth in ways that go from learning all the way through to employment in areas related to the sciences. What they aspire to be in the future is a platform that will allow them to express science in every conceivable manner that the public will be able to grasp and utilize. They want to be a community pool of science, if you will. They want to provide a contemplative space where science is studied, but they also want to be a platform for engaging in citizen science and moving science out into the community. They want to be a location where scientists can come in and have objective dialogues and discussions. They want to be learning labs for innovation for youth, all in the same common, and I might argue, fun platform. So how do we go about facilitating connections between these kinds of centers around the world? Well, there are several mechanisms for doing it. One mechanism, which we have found to be of growing opportunity, if you will, is to embody the whole concept of connections between informal learning communities within our government-to-government agreements on science cooperation. Here is an example of a recent agreement between the U.S. and China on cooperation in science and technology. And we made a point to include a reference to the fact that the two sides will investigate innovative programs that will enhance our interactions of science, involving journalists and science and museum professionals and educators. And our goal is to boost public understanding of science issues in both countries. So it can be facilitated at the government-to-government level. Similarly, these institutions, these science centers and science museums, are working side by side more often now with the fundamental leading international priorities for science, such as the International Years and the Global Summits. The International Year on Biodiversity was a great example, where we had science centers coming together, providing 1,300 programs and events that really focused on providing a global response with respect to biodiversity. What you will see happen when these groups come together is enormous media role as a result of this, the exchange and the dialogue that occurs in the media as a result of work done by science centers has a tremendous ripple effect. I want to now reference a few programs that we are doing in my own association, and my association is made up of 600 institutions in 44 countries around the world. And they are driven in part by museums and science centers of that sort, but more and more they involve other organizations, research laboratories, corporations, universities, and other organizations who feel that they have a responsibility and a need to reach the public and engage the public more actively in science. So we've run a series of pilot programs in preparation for the Rio Plus 20 summit that will be coming up, focusing on global issues of sustainability, where in order to tackle the issue, we are requiring that science centers in different parts of the world come together around this issue, identify a common set of themes, and identify how their local concern is global at the same time. And you'll see from a few of these, the first one I reference here is global energy consumption. We have a Canadian, a Danish, and a U.S. Institution working together on the common issue of global energy consumption. We have another one on water and coastal management, and here Colombia, working together with our center in Miami, Florida, is very, very active in what we are looking dealing with in coastal issues and sustainability. A fourth project focused on climate change has a special emphasis on health and the environment. And here again, between Brazil and Mozambique, we are looking at issues associated with sustainability from local perspectives, but brought together and ultimately will be presented in a global context at the summit in Rio. The fourth project on water and health, very much the same concept, where our Australian colleagues and our Singapore colleagues and our Chinese colleagues are all working together on a particular aspect of water management that is focused on priorities for health. But you can see in this particular example how there is a difference between becoming self-sustaining with regard to water and managing that water properly in its next phase. Those are each local concerns, but they are in a global context. And these science centers will work on them locally, but they will present them as global issues. Now, I said that I would conclude this by talking about something that's fun. Some of these projects, in some instances, it is the simplest project that can have the greatest cooperative and global impact. We did a very interesting experiment some years back called the Albedo Experiment on the subject of global warming, and it was a very simple process. Essentially, students from around the world created a white spot on the ground, 15 meters by 15 meters. And that white spot, all of these spots created simultaneously, were done in the context of the International Polar Year. And three NASA satellites orbiting the Earth monitored the effect of these 15-meter by 15-meter white spots on the ground. It was no more complicated than this process. But the net effect, as one might imagine, of measuring the temperature gradients resulted in, first of all, almost 2,000 participants from nearly 20 centers around the world doing these studies, students ages grade 1 through grade 12, working with teachers and with parents and with other media groups, and you can see them pulling out the white sheets here in this photo. The result was an enormous media reaction to such a simple study done in different parts of the world and done collaboratively. Ultimately, we saw a total circulation of more than 1.7 billion readership from this one particular program. It is a very simple area of science cooperation, and it is a fun area of science cooperation. infinitely doable. This is what we're trying to do in the informal science arena, and my hope is that through the science centers that we work with throughout the world, that we will see more and more of these kinds of programs attached to our global agendas, but very connected to the needs of the local communities. I have a last video in here, which I'm not going to show in the interest of time. But it was done in Singapore, and I will only say to you this. It is remarkable that the best aspects of this particular work in the science arena is to look at an enormous number of smiling faces from young people who are engaged in this kind of work. It's a wonderful area. Thank you very much.